Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Author Sylvain Neuvel sold the movie rights to his first book before it was even a book. So how did that happen? Well, we share that in our conversation today. Suffice to say for now, publishers heard about it and started a bidding war for a manuscript that had previously been rejected by 56 agents. It's a great testament there to never giving up. Today we're talking about Sylvain's latest series. It's his Take Them to the Stars trilogy. A History of What Comes Next was the first in that series. And the second book just released is Until the Last of Me. It's described as a darkly satirical thriller, a meticulously researched work of historical fiction with a futuristic spin, and an action-packed adventure seen through the eyes of women who sacrifice all to make progress possible, and the men determined to stop them. So a little bit about my guest. Sylvain Neuvel has taught linguistics in India. He's worked as a software engineer in Montreal. And his debut novel, Sleeping Giants, was described by NPR as one of the most promising series kickoffs in recent memory. And today, of course, we're talking about his Take Them to the Stars trilogy. We do look at both books, but the latest book in that series is Until the Last of Me. And here's my guest, Sylvain Neuvel. Sylvain Neuvel, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you here because this is a really different book and lots to talk about it. But we haven't chatted before, so I wanted just to take a couple of minutes here to learn a little bit about your background and share that with our listeners. It sounds as though you've definitely had an interesting lead up to where you are today. You're from Quebec. You started school at 15. You left school at 15 and started traveling for a decade or so. And then went back to school, which is actually the way I think it should be, travel first, then school. Was there any benefit for you doing it that way? What was it?
Well, you know, you gain life experience, which is sort of valuable no matter what you do afterwards. I mean, I wouldn't advise anyone to drop out of school at 15. That may not be the greatest path to success. I got lucky. I mean, 100% lucky. I traveled for a decade. I went back to school, did a BA in linguistics in Montreal, and I was going to go back to work because I was tired of eating ramen. And so my professor said, you should go to the States, do a PhD. Yes, where? It said, well, apply to any school you think you have absolutely no shot of getting in. And I did that, ended up being accepted at Yale and the University of Chicago, got a PhD in Chicago, loved the city, and then I came back. I thought I was going to teach. Somehow I got a job as a software engineer because life.
What did you get your PhD in?
Linguistics.
Linguistics, yeah. Sorry, I missed, yep. Missed that bit. Go ahead.
And I have a son. He's 12 now, but back then he was a kid. He was like 2, maybe 3. And I offered to build him a toy robot. And instead of just saying yes, Dad, like a kid should, he started asking questions like, "What kind of robot? What does it do? Does it fly? Does it have pilots?" He wanted a backstory to go with a toy. So I started writing something, and very quickly it turned into a novel for adults, which was my debut, Sleeping Giants. So I tried to get it published. I thought it was pretty good. No one wanted it. I sent it to like 56 agents, and they all said no. I think one of them read the whole thing. So I said, you know, I have a good job. I'll self-publish, sell 20 copies. That'll give me an excuse to write book two. I could sell 10 copies of that. But I like things to look professional, so I sent it to a literary magazine in the U.S., and they came back with this raving review, and they put it online. And I started getting emails from Hollywood producers, not from people from the book this is great. I think you need a movie agent. And he hooked me up with someone at Creative Artists Agency. And so I talked to this guy on the phone. And he says, I love your book. I'd love to be your agent. I said, what do I do? He said, well, you say yes. I'm like, okay, yes. So I hang up, go tell my wife, I have an agent at Creative Artists Agency. And we're laughing, right? Because, you know, it spices up the week, but nothing will come of that. Well, a week later, he calls back, says, we have an offer from a major studio. By the way, are you hell-bent on self-publishing? Because I know this book agent in New York, their agency represents John Grisham, and I'd like you to talk to him. So I talked to that guy. He says, love your book. Would love to be your agent. I said, okay, what do I do? He says, well, you say yes. So I hang up. Tell my wife, I have a book agent now in New York. And a week later, my book auctions with four of the big five publishers at the table. And suddenly, within a month, I go from, you know, I'm a software engineer writing part-time after my son goes to bed, to I have a three-book deal and a movie deal, and that's my life now.
Yeah, it's a pretty fantastic story. It's very rare to hear stories like that, but we all love to hear them. And, it's sometimes just landing on the right desk at the right time, the right person, isn't it? It's sometimes, you know, having the stars aligned, which is a little appropriate since your three-book series, your trilogy, is a Take Them to the Stars trilogy.
Yes, they do align.
They do align, right. And so let's take a look at the series, Sylvain. We're two books in so far. The first one is just came out in paperback, A History of What Comes Next. That was out in hardback. It's just come out in paperback. And the newest one, the second in the trilogy, is Until the Last of Me. So I want to begin with a note that you wrote to your editor. It's in the back of your book, and you thank him for giving, and I'm going to quote here, your weird, slightly homicidal alien clone space race story, a home. That's a great description of it. And it's described as a fast-moving, the second book here, we're talking about a fast-moving, darkly satirical look at the 1960s space race that explores the amorality of progress and the nature of violence. So I think that sums it up pretty well. So I wonder if we could just take a quick look, since, you know, the two books are connected and I have seen them both together. Let's take a quick look at the first one, because it does kind of set up the story line since it's a trilogy. It's about a race called Kipsu and pairs of what you call kick-ass mothers and daughters, all genetically identical. Would you tell us the premise of the series?
Yeah, so it is indeed about kick-ass mothers and daughters, 100 generations of them, actually, all genetically identical, and they've been messing with our history for the last 3,000 years, hoping to nudge us towards the stars so we can, well, so some of us can escape our impending doom. The first book is about the 99th generation with the mother Sarah and her daughter Mia. And it's set at the very beginning of the space race, right after the Second World War. And they participate in actual real-life events, trying to set up what will actually become the space race. The second book, Until the Last of Me, follows Mia, who's now the mother, and her daughter Lola, mostly in the 70s and early 80s. As they go on a quest to find out about their past and who they are and what they do, where they are, all while being chased by some very, very bad people.
Right, the trackers, right? The scary dudes.
They're not nice.
No, they're not nice. They're quite chilling. But you've got to have those characters in a book to make it exciting, you know? So let's talk about these women. In the second book, they are the 100th pair, Mia and her daughter Lola. These women are all genetically identical. And I heard that you got this idea from a fish. There's a fish that lives on the borders of Texas and Mexico, and it tricks other species to do something to its egg. I can't remember the exact term. What is it? It's gynogenesis or something like that.
Yes. former gynotenesis. They're super cool. They're called the Amazon Molly. You could get a lot of ideas from fish. and this one, strict, a male of a species that resembles it into mating with them, and then they pass on all their genes to their offspring and none of the male genes. So they're all the same fish, genetically. And they're all female. There are no males of that species. It's really cool. And it's also sort of interesting because I write science fiction, and you try to come up with things that are, you know, somewhat fantastic, and, you know, nature turns around and says, hold my beer, and comes up with something just as wild. But when I got the idea, it was like a eureka moment, because I'd been wanting to write characters that could span centuries or millennia, and I didn't know how to do it. Didn't want to write vampires or immortal characters. And so when I heard about when I read about this fish, I thought, this is fantastic, because now I can have characters that are, well, more or less the same, because they're genetically identical, but at the same time, they're born at different times, they go through different lives in different eras with different values, and they, you know, they shape themselves into their own person.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the same and yet different. It was fantastic.
So let's take a look about how you took that idea, you turned it into these women, which are incredible women, they're very powerful women, and yet the Kibsu race, their rule number one is run, don't fight. So tell us a little bit of the premise of how the Kibsu lives.
Well, for 3,000 years, they had a reason for doing all this, but they lost a lot of the knowledge a while back. And now what they're left with is this goal of them, of theirs, to take us to the stars, and they live by a handful of rules that they set for themselves thousands of years ago. The first one is fear the tracker. Always run, never fight, because the tracker has been hunting them for, 3,000 years. And he's also many, and he, again, sort of recycles himself through history. And they have other rules, which are more or less sort of designed to keep him alive as well. So preserve the knowledge so they can, you know, learn, move forward. Don't leave a trace. Don't draw attention to yourself. Survive at all costs, because that's important. And the last rule, which is a little harder to live with, is there can never be three for too long. When a new Kibsu is born, the grandmother eventually sort of has to disappear.
Mm. Right. And so one of the things that I found interesting is the character of Mia, because she is a young girl she's 19 in the first book, A History of What Comes Next. And then by the time we get to Until the Last of Me, she's a woman with her own child. What's it like for you as a male to get into the female psyche?
I don't know. I mean, I sort of approach these characters from to sort of basically draw on what's special about them. And they're, you know, when we grow up, we keep saying, you know, I don't want to turn into my parents. And
we all do.
Yeah. But that takes an entirely new meaning if you're a genetic copy of your mother and you look exactly like her when she was your age. And you know that your child will look exactly like you and be, you know, and you try to somehow through all that develop your own personality and your own sense of self. And so that's mostly what I try to draw on to craft these characters.
Right, because that's something Mia struggles with, is her wanting her individuality and but also conforming with the Kibsu, the rest of the Kibsu.
Yeah, it's hard to sort of, you know, if anyone who's familiar with what it is to be in a family business, especially a farm, say you're on a farm, you're like the seventh generation on that farm, and suddenly you decide that you don't want to work the farm, and giving up on that is like sort of is giving up on seven generations of your family and you know, their entire goal. They built that farm so you could have it at some point. And that's super hard. Well, imagine giving up on 100 generations and 3,000 years of work and sacrifice and,
right,
you know, and fight and death. And so it's heartbreaking for them trying to choose between their legacy and their individuality.
Right, right. Well, I can relate a little to that because I'm the third generation in my family business. And I did work in it for a while, but I left after about 5 years. So there's that tug. I get that to a little extent there. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about these chilling trackers and how you developed them.
Well, in the first book, we don't see that much of them.
Right.
So they're essentially the bad guys in a more classical sense. But at the very end of the book, we learn that they're not just, you know, psychopaths who are trying to kill everyone. They have a reason for doing all this, and we learn what it is. In the second book, we get to spend more time with them. One of them in particular, who goes through some sort of epiphany and tries to redefine himself in some way. I mean, emphasis on tries. It's not necessarily, doesn't always work, but he certainly does his best. So we get to learn more about them and how it is to live their life, because they have the same sort of genetic peculiarity, meaning that if they have a child, it will be a son and it will look exactly like him, but they have a mother, which is the sort of main difference. They can't, the Kipsu will need a man at some point, but for a few minutes, whereas the trackers are actually raised by someone, by a human mother, and it changes them somehow. And they struggle with that for completely different reasons, but because they're taught by their dad by their father to reject their humanity, but they've spent the first months, years of their lives with a human mother who taught them differently, and some of them struggle with it more than others.
Mm. And they are, they're very determined, that even to the point of wanting to, you know, willing to sacrifice themselves for the greater good. I mean, that's how they approach this chase of the Kipsu, right?
Yeah, they'll stop at just that nothing. And I mean, they have a view of themselves that is somewhat different. They know what the Kipsu, the knowledge that the Kipsu is lost, they have it. They know why they're here. They know who they are. But on their world, they wouldn't be what they are. They wouldn't be copies of each other forever. And so they see themselves as sort of like this defective leftover from another era. And they just want their quest to be over so they could stop and, you know, live what life they have and then eventually just die.
Hmm. Now, I read that you were actually writing this second book, Until the Last of Me, in Indonesia before the pandemic, and you had to come home because of the pandemic. What was that experience like writing in Indonesia? Because you're in a different, it's not an alien world, obviously, but it's a different environment. Did it help inform the story in any way?
I don't know, perhaps. I've traveled in Asia a lot. I've been to India a few times, Indonesia, the Philippines, China. It puts you in a different mindset. It was a very strange experience because I wasn't there alone. My entire family was there. We were homeschooling our kid for 6 months. The three of us in a small room. So it had its challenges. But it was super fun. I mean, I wish we could have stayed longer. We had to fly back when the world was going to hell.
Right. Yeah, it's quite a challenge writing in a small room with two other people there. I mean, you're not one of those people, I guess, who has to be sequestered to write then.
No, but for these books, there's a playlist that goes with each of them.
Yeah.
So chapter titles are song titles from the year or the years the story takes place in. And I wrote each chapter to its own song, listening to it. So the headphones did help a little bit with the three people in one room.
Right. Right. And I love that you put the playlist at the back of the book, and it's available on Spotify too. I love that. But let's talk about the first playlist for A History of What Comes Next, because that book begins in Germany in 1945. And of course, you've got some really old songs on there. I mean, one of them was from 1916. Did you have to go research those songs, or were these songs that you kind of heard from grandparents or parents, whatever?
Oh, no, I knew nothing. And this one was hard because half the book is set in 1945. And well, it's not the greatest year for music. The song sounds very similar. And one of the problems is, like, every single song is a love song, which didn't fit any of the chapters. So I listened to, I don't know, maybe 500 songs just to fill that 1945 era and find ones that would match the mood and the tone of each chapter. So it took forever. On the upside, I discovered a lot of great music. I really like that playlist. I've never been a fan of oldies, but I think it's a really good playlist. The playlist on the second book is like a sort of a more instant crowd pleaser, because it's like from the best era of music. It starts in 1968, and you get the late 60s, 70s, and early 80s.
Right, David Bowie and all those goodies. But I actually like the first playlist too, because my mother inherited this old gramophone from her mom, and so we'd got all these old LPs, and so I was quite familiar with a lot of those on the old playlist.
So, oh, I love a gramophone.
Yeah, it was one of those things we used to have. I remember winding it up as a kid. I just thought it was fascinating. So when you're listening to the playlist, does it really help put you in the mood?
When I was writing, certainly. My other books, I wrote to music a lot, but, you know, each song wasn't, like, tailored to the chapter I was writing, so I was trying to find music that fits any mood, any circumstance, from, like, a quiet moment to a fight scene, and Pat Benatar is pretty much the
Isn't that funny? I listen a lot to Leonard Cohen when I'm writing. There's something about the resonance of his voice that just kind of really chills me out and gets me in a state of flow somehow.
Yeah. Well, he's in there too. He's in there.
Yes, I saw. Yeah. So you did a ton of research for this book. I mean, the story spans the globe, for one thing. It's, you know, fantasy, science fiction. It's alternate history. You researched everything from a high priestess from, I think it was 600 BC, to early astronomers, the science of the black hole, even Led Zeppelin. What surprised you the most when you were doing all of your research?
Oh, I don't know. I did so much. I envy people who write what they know. Like, I love those, you know, reading about someone who was like a detective in real life and now writes detective novels. And it must be so reassuring. I write things that I want to know, but I have to research every single thing forever. So this was endless, you know, from the earliest steps in astronomy back when they could look at stars but didn't know what a star was, to the physics behind rockets, because they're working. They have to do things that make sense. Historical events. Every single event in the first book actually happened. I just threw in my characters in there somehow. Mm-hmm. I learned, I don't know what was more surprising. Well, I learned about fish, for one thing. The space program is full of little surprising nuggets. Book two deals with the Voyager program. And that project is amazing. I think it's one of the greatest achievements in humanity's history. It's impossible, and yet we did it. I mean, it starts with hurling something the size of a Mini Cooper at a planet that's millions of miles away and hoping to hit it just right so it can use its gravity to pick up speed and go on to the next planet. And the conditions for this to even happen imply a rare planetary alignment that occurs once every 175 years. And this is done with technology that's like so behind the times. Voyager recorded data on 8 track tapes. If we'd been behind just a couple years on technology, there was no way we could have done that for another 175 years.
Right. It's pretty fascinating. So how much time do you spend on research? Do you set out with certain goals, or do you just kind of meander and one thing leads to another?
I don't know. I have an academic background. I guess it doesn't help. I happen to enjoy research.
I do,
so
too.
Probably too much time. I don't want to calculate. I certainly don't want to say it on the radio so my editor could hear how much time I spent researching everything. But, yeah, too much. Certainly too much. I can't do things sort of halfway. So, for example, in my first trilogy in particular, if my characters would go to a restaurant, or it's a real restaurant, so I would read reviews so they would order the right food, because you don't want your characters to eat bad food.
Mm-hmm.
And it never stops, really.
Yeah. Your book is on the front of Until the Last of Me. It's blurbed by James Rollins, and he's been on the show many times, and he calls your book exciting, thought-provoking, and ultimately shocking. It takes a lot to shock James Rollins, I think. But he's told me that he does his research, and at 6 months he clicks off the research button. Otherwise, he'd just keep going and going and going.
Yeah, I don't have that off button. I envy him. He's the nicest guy. We did thing online. When the first book came out, he's the greatest.
Yeah. So I heard that you are a big plotter. What does that look like for you when you've got your story concept and you've thought through, you know, some of the things that you want to include or where you're heading? What does that look like for you?
Well, I spend just about the same amount of time plotting than I do writing. My first trilogy is epistolary. It's mostly dialogue between a mysterious interviewer and different people. So I had to set up all the events, figure out which to include in the book, which to let people sort of figure out for themselves, and then should the chapter be before the fact, during the fact, after the fact, who would be the right character to do it, what their take on it would be. And once I had all that, I started writing. I usually write like the key moments in a chapter. Sometimes it's just one sentence, one line, someone will say something, and that's sort of the essence of the chapter. And I do that, and then I start layering, and I just add meat to it. I'm one of the few people whose books grow when I edit.
Oh, they do. It does.
It's sort of a literary lasagna.
There you go, I like that. That's funny. So I'd like to throw out a couple of words to you and just see what they mean to you. So the first word I'd like to throw out is discipline. What does that mean to you?
Not as much as it should. I set myself very, very, very reasonable goals. Because I think the worst thing a writer can do is set themselves up to be disappointed in themselves, because sort of, you know, self-esteem and self-worth are like essential to this job. And if you start hating yourself for not being productive enough in one day, you're just going to hurt yourself in the long run. So I set myself like very, very, very reasonable goals that I'm pretty much sure to reach, and sometimes I need to take a break, so I do. I guess I'm disciplined in the way that I listen to myself. I don't force things too much.
I like that. And what about creativity? It sounds like you're very creative in all forms, but what does creativity mean to you?
I have a very Cartesian mind. Like I was good at math. So I, when I have an idea, sometimes it's just an image or something. Most of my books sort of are articulated around some very visual scenes, and then I try to plot around that, and I keep playing with it until it fits. And I've had that experience before in the academic world when you write an academic paper and you do some, you know, you work on some theory and you can't figure things out, and at some point you have this idea and it makes everything click. And I think plotting is sort of the same way. I'm happy with an idea when it fits, the same way a good scientific theory just explains the facts you're looking at perfectly.
Right. Well, Sylvain Nouvel, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Such an interesting series. It's the Take Them to the Stars trilogy series. Two books are out right now. Until The Last of Me is the latest one. And the first one was A History of What Comes Next. I know listeners can find out much more about you and your work at your website, which is nouvel.net. Final thought you'd like to share with them before you leave today?
Well, the pandemic's been rough. Of course, I'd like everyone to buy my books, but the pandemic has been rough on publishing as a whole, and a lot of people got their debut published during the worst possible times, right. And they went more or less unnoticed. So if you have the time and the money, go to your local bookstore and ask them for someone's debut that came out during this mess. And it will really help them, because you never get a second chance to get your first book out. So.
I love that. That's really generous. Generous thought, and I like that a lot. Thank you for sharing that. And again, my guest, Sylvain Nouvel, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. That was fun.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.